Keenan has been with the Resistance for years.
What are years when one has lived for millennia?
At the look of dumb shock on my face, the thing, the djinn, lets out a strange sound. It might be a sigh. Then it turns, whispering something into the air, slowly rising up as if to depart. No! I lunge forward and grab onto him, desperate to understand what in the skies is happening. Beneath the robe, the creature's body is burning hot, powerful, with the warped musculature of a demon instead of a man. The Nightbringer tilts his head. He has no face, only those damned fiery eyes. Still, I can sense him sneering.
"Ah, the little girl has fight in her after all," he says. "Just like her stone-hearted bitch of a mother."
He shakes me, attempting to free himself, but I hold tight even while squelching my revulsion at touching him. An unknown darkness rises within me, some atavistic part of myself that I did not know existed. The Nightbringer, I sense, is no longer amused. He jerks away hard. I make myself hold on. "What did you do to Keenan, the Keenan I knew, the Keenan I loved?" I scream in my mind. "And why?" I glare into his eyes, the darkness rising, taking over. I sense alarm from the Nightbringer, and surprise. "Tell me, now!" Quite suddenly, I am weightless as I fly into the chaos of the Nightbringer's mind, into his memories. At first, I see nothing. I only feel sadness, an ache that he's buried beneath centuries of life. It permeates every part of him, and though I am bodiless, my mind nearly collapses from the weight of it. I force myself through it, and I stand in a cold alley in Sarah's scholar quarter. Wind bites through my clothing, and I hear a strangled cry. I turn to find the Nightbringer, changing, screaming in pain as he uses all his power to morph into a red-headed child of five. He staggers out of the alley and into the street beyond, collapsing on the stoop of a dilapidated house. Many seek to help him, but he does not speak to anyone, not until an achingly familiar, dark-haired man stops and kneels beside him. My father. He scoops up the child. The memory shifts to an encampment deep in a canyon. Resistance fighters eat, chatter, train with weapons. Two figures sit at a table, and my heart drops when I see them. My mother and Liss. They welcome my father and the red-headed child. They offer him a plate of stew and tend his wounds. Liss gives him a wooden cat that father carved for her, and she sits beside him so he is not afraid. Even as the memory shifts again, I think back to a cold and rainy day in the Commandant's kitchen months ago, when Cook told Izzy and me a story about the Nightbringer.
"He infiltrated the Resistance, took human form and posed as a fighter. Got close to your mother, manipulated and used her. Your father caught on. Nightbringer had help. A traitor."
The Nightbringer didn't have help, and he didn't pose as a fighter. He was the traitor, and he posed as a child. For no one would think a young, starving orphan could be a spy. A snarl echoes in my mind, and the Nightbringer tries to fling me from his thoughts. I feel myself returning to my body, but the darkness within roars and fights, and I do not let myself release him. "No, you will show me more. I need to understand." Back in the creature's memories, I see him befriend my lonely sister. I grow uneasy at their friendship. It seems so real, as if he truly cares about her. At the same time, he wheedles information from her about my parents, where they are, what they are doing. He stalks my mother, his covetous eyes fixed on her armlet. His hunger for it is like that of a starving animal in its potency. He doesn't want it. He needs it. He must get her to give it to him. But one day, my mother arrives at the Resistance encampment without the armlet. The Nightbringer has failed. I feel his fury, overlaid by that yawning sadness. He arrives in a torchlit barracks and speaks to a familiar, silver-faced woman, Keris Baturia. He tells Keris where she can find my parents. He tells her what they will be doing. Traitor! You led them to their deaths! I rage at him, forcing myself further into his mind. Why? Why the armlet? I fly with him deep into the past, streaming along the winds to the far-flung forest of dusk. I feel his desperation and panic for his people. They face a grave danger at the hands of a scholar coven bent on stealing their power, and he cannot get to them fast enough. Too late, he howls in the memory. I am too late. He cries out the names of his kin as a shockwave ripples out from the center of the forest, throwing him into darkness. An explosion of pure silver. A star. The scholar's weapon, used to imprison the djinn. I expect it to disintegrate. I know the story. But it does not. Instead, it shatters into hundreds of shards flung across the land. Shards that are picked up by mariners and scholars, marshals and tribesmen, fashioned into necklaces and armlets, spearheads and blades. The Nightbringer's rage steals my breath, for he cannot simply take back these pieces. Each time he finds one, he must ensure that it is offered freely, in absolute love and trust. For that is the only way he can reassemble the weapon that imprisoned his people, so he might set them free again. My stomach churns as I hurtle through his memories, watching as he transforms himself into husband or lover, son or brother, friend or confidant. Whatever is necessary to get the lost shards. He becomes whomever he transforms into. He creates them. He is them. He feels what a human would feel, including love. And then I watch as he discovers me. I see myself through his eyes, a nobody, a naive little girl come to beg the resistance for aid. I watch as he realizes who I am and what I possess. It is torture to witness how he deceived me, how he used information stolen from my brother to win me over, to get me to trust him, to care for him. In Sarah, he'd been close, so close to getting me to fall for him. But then I gave Izzy the freedom he'd offered me, and I disappeared with Elias, and his carefully wrought plan fell to pieces. And all the while, he had to keep his cover among the resistance in order to carry out a plan months in the making, persuading the rebels to kill the Emperor and rise up in the Scholar Revolution. Two actions that allowed the Commandant to unleash an unchecked genocide upon my people. It was the Nightbringer's revenge for what the scholars did to his kin centuries before. Pleading skies. 100 little things suddenly make sense. How cold he was when he first met me. How well he seemed to know me, even when I hadn't told him about myself. How he used his voice to soothe me. How strange the weather was when Elias and I first set out from Sarah. How the attacks on us by supernatural creatures stopped after he arrived with Izzy. Oh, no. You liar. You monster. As soon as I think it, I sense something deep within him that underlies every memory and shakes me to my core. A sea of regret he strives to hide, stirred into madness as if by some great tempest. I see my own face, then Lys's face. I see a child with brown braids and an ancient silver necklace. I see a smiling, crook-backed mariner holding a silver-topped cane. Haunted. It is the only word to describe what I see. The Nightbringer is haunted. As the full weight of what this creature is rolls over me, I gasp, and he casts me from his mind and his body. I fly back a dozen feet, slamming into a tree and sinking to the ground, breathless. My armlet glimmers on his tenebrous wrist, a silver, tarnished black for most of my life. Gleams now, as if made of starlight.
"What in the skies are you?"
he hisses. The words trigger a memory. The Ifrit back in Sarah asking me the same thing.
"You say what am I, but what are you?"
A frosty night wind blows into the clearing, and the Nightbringer rises up on it. His eyes are still fixed on me, hostile and curious. Then the wind whooshes past, taking him with it. The woods are silent. The skies above are still. My heart thuds as madly as a martial war drum. I close my eyes and open them, waiting to wake up from this nightmare. I reach for my armlet, needing the comfort it offers, the reminder of who I am, what I am. But it is gone. I am alone.
Part 4. Unmade. Chapter 46. Elias.
You're getting close, Elias.
When I fall into the waiting place, Shaver stares at me. There is a crispness to her, to the trees and the sky, that makes it seem as if this is my reality, and the waking world is the dream. I look around curiously. I have only ever woken up amid the thick trunks of the forest. But this time, I stand atop a rocky bluff that overlooks the trees. The river dusk surges below, blue and white beneath the bright winter sky.
The poison is nearly to your heart, Shaver says.
Death so soon. Not yet, I make myself say through numb lips, squelching the fear that threatens. I need to ask you something. I beg you, Shaver, hear me out. Pull it together, Elias. Make her understand how important this is. Because if I die before I'm ready, I will haunt these damned trees forever. You'll never be rid of me. Something crosses her face, a flicker of disquiet that fades in less than a second.
Very well, she says. Ask.
I consider all that the warden told me. You asked who, he'd said, instead of what. No human controls the warden. It must be one of the Fae. But I cannot imagine a wraith or a frit manipulating the warden. Such weak creatures could not best him in a battle of wits, and he spits upon those he perceives to have a weaker intellect than him. But then, not all Fae creatures are wraiths or ifrits. Why would the Nightbringer be interested in a 17-year-old girl travelling to Koth to break her brother out of prison? The colour drains from the soul-catcher's face. Her hand flutters at her side, as if she is trying to catch herself on a bulwark that doesn't exist.
Why would you ask such a thing?
Just answer.
Because she has something he wants,
the soul catcher sputters.
But he cannot possibly know she has it. It has been hidden for years, and he has been dormant.
Not as dormant as you'd like. He's in league with my mother, I say. And the warden. The old man has been passing information about Lyra to someone traveling with us, a scholar rebel. Shaver's eyes widen fearfully, and she steps forward, reaching out.
Take my hands, Elias, she says, and close your eyes.
Despite the urgency of her tone, I hesitate. At my obvious wariness, the soul-catcher's mouth hardens, and she springs forward to grab me. I yank my hands back, but her fey reflexes are swifter. When she takes hold, the earth beneath me twitches. I stumble as a thousand doors in my mind fly open. Lyra telling me her story in the desert outside Serra. Darin speaking of the warden. Keenan's oddities. The fact that he tracked me when he shouldn't have been able to. The rope between Lyra and me that came apart in the desert. The soul catcher fixes her black eyes on me and opens her own mind. Her thoughts pour into my head in a white water rush, and when she is done, she takes my memories and her knowledge and lays the fruit of that union at my feet.
bleeding, burning hells.
I stumble back from her and catch myself on a boulder, finally understanding. Liar's armlet. The star.
It's him, Keenan. He's the Nightbringer.
Do you see it, Elias?
The soulcatcher asks.
Do you see the web he spun to ensure his revenge?
Why the games?
I push up from the boulder and pace across the bluff.
Why not just kill Lyre and take the armlet?
The star is bound by unbreakable laws. The knowledge that led to its creation was given in love, in trust.
She looks away, shame in her eyes.
It is an old magic, meant to limit any evil the star might be used for.
She sighs.
Much good it has done.
The djinn living within your grove of trees, I say.
He wants to free them.
Shaver's eyes are troubled as she stares down into the river below.
They should not be free, Elias. The djinn were creatures of light once. But as with any living thing that is jailed for too long, their imprisonment has driven them mad. I have tried to tell this to the Nightbringer. Of all the djinn, he and I are the only two who still walk this land. But he does not listen to me.
We have to do something, I say. When he gets the armlet, he'll kill Lyre.
He cannot kill her. All who have been given the star, even if only for a few moments, are protected from him by its power. He can't kill you either.
But I never...
touched it, I was going to say, until I realized that I asked Lyre if I could see it months ago, in the Seren Range.
The Nightbringer must have ordered the Warden to kill you,
Shaver says.
But his human slaves are not as obedient, perhaps, as he would like.
The Warden didn't care about Lyre, I realize. He wanted to understand the Nightbringer better.
My king confides in no one.
The soulcatcher shivers at the crisp air. For a moment, she looks barely older than me.
The commandant and the warden are likely his only allies. He does not trust humans. He will have told them nothing of the armlet or the star, lest they find a way to turn the knowledge against him.
What if Lyre had died some other way? I ask. What would have happened to her armlet?
Those who bear pieces of the star do not die easily, Shaver says. It protects them, and he knows that. But if she had, the armlet would have evanesced into nothingness. The star's power would have weakened. It has happened before.
She puts her head in her hands.
No one understands how deep his hatred for humans runs, Elias. If he frees our brethren, they will search out the scholars and annihilate them. They will turn on the rest of humanity. Their bloodlust will know no reason.
Then we stop him, I say. We get Lyre away before he can take the armlet.
I cannot stop him!
Shaver's voice rises in impatience.
He will not let me. I cannot leave my lands.
Shaver!
A tremor rolls through the forest, and Shaver twists around.
They know,
she hisses.
They'll punish me.
You can't just leave. I have to find out if Lyre's all right. You could help me.
No!
Shaver rears back.
I can have nothing to do with this. Nothing! Don't you see? He...
She reaches for her throat and grimaces.
The last time I crossed him, he killed me, Elias. He forced me to suffer the torture of a slow death, and then he
brought me back. He released the sorry creature that had ruled the land of death before me, and he chained me to this place as punishment for what I did. I live, yes, but I am a slave to the waiting place. That is his doing. If I cross him again, skies know what he will inflict upon me. I am sorry, more sorry than you can know, but I have no power over him. I lunge for her, desperate to make her help me, but she spins out of my grasp and darts down the bluff, disappearing within seconds into the trees. Shaver! Damn it! I start after her, swearing when I realize how futile it is.
Aren't you dead yet?
Tristus emerges from the trees as the soulcatcher disappears.
How much longer are you planning to cling to your miserable existence?
I should ask you the same. But I do not. For instead of the malice I've come to expect from Tristus's ghost, his shoulders slump, as if an invisible boulder rests on his back. Distracted as I am, I order myself to turn my full attention to my friend. He looks drawn and desperately unhappy. I'll be here soon enough, I say. I haven't told Rathana. That's 6 days away.
Rathana.
Tristus wrinkles his forehead in thought. I remember last year. Aelia proposed to me that night. I sang all the way home, and you and Hel gagged me so the centurions wouldn't hear. Varys and Leander teased me for weeks. They were just jealous that you'd met a girl who truly loved you.
You defended me,
Tristus says. Behind him, the forest is still, as if the waiting place holds its breath.
You always did.
I shrug and look away. That doesn't undo the evil I've done.
Never said it did.
Tristus's ire returns.
But you're not the judge, are you? It's my life you took. It's my choice whether I wish to forgive you or not.
I open my mouth, about to tell him that he shouldn't forgive me. Instead, I think of Izzy's reprimand.
You always think everyone is your responsibility. We're our own people, and we deserve to make our own decisions.
You're right. Hells, it's hard to say. Harder to make myself believe. But as I speak, the anger clears from Tristus's eyes. All your choices have been taken from you. Except this one. I'm sorry. Tristus cocks his head.
Was that so hard?
He walks to the edge of the bluff and peers down at the river dusk.
You said I didn't have to do it alone.
You don't have to do it alone.
I could say the same to you.
Tristus puts a hand on my shoulder.
I forgive you, Elias. Forgive yourself. You still have time left among the living. Don't waste it.
He turns and leaps off the bluff in a perfect dive, his body fading. The only sign of his passing is a slight ripple in the river.
I could say the same to you.
The words kindle a flame within me, and the thought that first flickered to life with Izzy's words now grows into a blaze. Afia's strident assertion sounds in my head.
You shouldn't just leave Elias. You should ask Lyra what she wants.
Lyra's angry pleadings.
You close yourself up. You shut me out because you don't want me to get close. What about what I want? Sometimes,
Izzy had said,
loneliness is a choice.
The waiting place fades. When cold seeps into my bones, I know I am back in Koth. I also know exactly how I can get Darin out of this damned place. But I can't do it alone. I wait, planning, plotting. And when Tas enters my cell the morning after I learn the truth about Keenan, I am ready. The boy keeps his head down, shuffling toward me as timid as a mouse. His skinny legs are marked with a fresh whipping. A dirty bandage encircles his frail wrist. Tas, I whisper. The boy's dark eyes snap up. I'm getting out of here, I say. I'm taking the artist with me, and you too, if you wish. But I need help. Tas bends over his crate of bandages and ointments, his hands shaking as he changes a poultice on my knee. For the first time since I've met him, his eyes shine.
What do you need me to do, Elias Veturius?
Chapter 47. Helene. I do not recall hauling myself back up Koff's outer wall, or making my way to the boathouse. I only know that it takes longer than it should, because of the anger and disbelief clouding my sight. When I arrive within the cavernous structure, dazed by what I've just learned about the Commandant, the Warden awaits me. This time, he's not alone. I sense his men lurking in the corners of the boathouse. Glints of silver catch the blue torchlight. Masks, with arrows pointed at me. Avatar stands beside our boat, one wary eye turned toward the old man. His clenched jaw is the only sign that he's upset. His anger calms me. At least I am not alone in my frustration. As I approach, Avatas meets my gaze and nods curtly. The Warden has filled him in. Don't help the Commandant, Warden, I say without preamble. Don't give her the influence she wants.
You surprise me, the Warden says. Are you so loyal to Marcus that you would reject Caris Veturia as Empress? It's foolish to do so. The transition would not be seamless, but in time the populace would accept her. She did, after all, crush the Scholar Revolution.
If the Commandant was meant to be Empress, I say, the Augurs would have chosen her instead of Marcus. She does not know how to negotiate, Warden. The second she takes power, she'll punish every gens who has ever crossed her. And the Empire will fall to civil war, as it nearly did just weeks ago. Besides, she wants to kill you. She said as much in front of me.
I am well aware of Caris Veturia's dislike, he says. Irrational, when one considers that we serve the same master. But she is, I believe, threatened by my presence.
The Warden shrugs.
Whether I aid her or not makes no difference. She will still launch the coup, and it is very possible that it will succeed.
Then I must stop her. And now we've come to it, the crux of our discussion. I decide to forego subtlety. If the Commandant intends to launch a coup, I have no time. Give me Elias Veturius, Warden. I cannot return to Antium without him.
Ah, yes. The Warden taps his fingers together. That might be a problem, Shrike.
What do you want, Warden? The Warden gestures for me to walk with him down one of the docks, away from his men and Harper. The Northman shakes his head sharply when I follow, but I have no choice. When we are out of earshot, the old man turns to me.
I hear, Bloodshrike, that you have a specific skill.
He fixes his eyes on me hungrily, and a chill rolls up my spine. Warden, I don't know what you've heard, but
do not insult my intelligence. Blackcliff's physician, Titinius, is an old friend. He shared with me recently the most remarkable story of recovery he's witnessed in his time at the school. Elias Veturius was hovering on the edge of death
when a sudden poultice saved him. But when Titinius tried the poultice on another patient, it didn't work. He suspects that Elias's recovery was due to something, someone else. What, I say again, my hand straying to my weapon, do you want? I want to study your power, the warden says. I want to understand it. I don't have time for your experiments, I snap. Give me Elias and we'll talk. If I give you Viturius, you will simply abscond with him, the warden says. No, you must remain. A few days, no more, and then I'll release you both. Warden, I say, there's a bleeding coup that's going to take down the Empire. I must return to Antium to warn the Emperor, and I cannot return without Elias. Give him to me, and I vow by blood and by bone that I will come back here for your observation as soon as the situation is under control. A pretty vow, the warden says, but unreliable. He strokes his chin thoughtfully, an eerie light in his eyes. Such a fascinating philosophical quandary you face, Bloodstrike. Stay here, submit to experimentation, and risk that in your absence the Empire will fall to Carus Veturia. Or go back, stop the coup, and save the Empire, but risk forfeiting your family. This isn't a game, I say. My family's lives are at stake. Bleeding Hells, the Empire is at stake, and if neither of those things matter to you, then think of yourself, Warden. Do you think Carys will just let you lurk up here after she becomes Empress? She'll kill you the first chance she gets. Oh, I think our new Empress will find my knowledge of the Empire's secrets compelling. My blood seethes in hatred as I glare at the old man. Could I perhaps break into Koff? Avitas knows the prison well. He spent years here. But there are only two of us, and a fortress of the Warden's men. I remember then what Cain said to me when all this began, just after Marcus ordered me to bring him Elias. You will hunt Elias. You will find him. For what you learn on that journey, about yourself, your land, your enemies, that knowledge is essential to the Empire's survival and to your destiny. This is what he meant. I do not yet know what I have learned about myself, but I understand now what is happening within my land, within the Empire. I understand what my enemy is planning. I was going to bring Elias to Marcus for execution, to show the Emperor's strength, to give him a victory. But killing Elias isn't the only way to do that. Crushing a coup led by one of the Empire's most feared soldiers would work just as well. If Marcus and I take down the Commandant, the illustrian gens will be loath to cross him. Civil war will be averted. The Empire will be safe. As for Elias, my gut twists when I think of him in the hands of the Warden. But I cannot concern myself with his welfare any longer. Besides which, I know my friend. The Warden won't be able to keep him locked up for long. Empire first, old man, I say. You can keep Veturius, and your experiments. The Warden regards me without expression. Gallo is the hope of our youth, he murmurs. They are fools. They know no better. From recollections, by Rajan of Sera, one of the only scholars worth quoting. I believe he wrote that a few moments before Tyus, the first, lopped his head off. If you do not want your emperor's fate to be similar, then you'd best be on your way. He signals to his men, and moments later the door of the boathouse thuds shut behind them. Avitas pads silently to my side. "Nor Veturius, and a coup to stop," Avitas says. "Do you want to explain your thinking now?" he asks. "Or on the way?" "On the way." I step into the canoe and grab an oar. "We're already out of time."
Chapter 48 Liar. Keenan is the Nightbringer. A djinn. A demon. Though I repeat the words in my head, they do not penetrate. Cold seeps into my bones, and I look down, surprised to find I've fallen to my knees in the snow. "Get up, liar. I cannot move." I hate him. Skies, I hate him. But I loved him. Didn't I? I reach for my armlet, as if pouring at myself will make it reappear. Keenan's transformation flashes through my mind, then the mockery in his warped voice. "He's gone," I tell myself. "You're still alive. Elias and Darin are in the prison, and they have no way out. You have to save them. Get up." Perhaps grief is like battle. After experiencing enough of it, your body's instincts take over. When you see it closing in like a martial death squad, you harden your insides. You prepare for the agony of a shredded heart, and when it hits, it hurts. But not as badly, because you have locked away your weakness, and all that's left is anger and strength. Part of me wants to mull over every moment spent with that thing. Did he oppose my mission with Mazin because he wanted me alone and weak? Did he save Izzy because he knew I'd never forgive him if he left her behind? No thinking, no considering. You must act, move, get up. I stand, though I am at first unsure of where I'm going. I make myself walk away from the cave. The snow drifts reach my knees and I plow through, shivering, until I find the trail Helene Aquila and her men must have left. I follow it to a trickle of a stream and walk along the waterway. I don't realize where I am walking until a figure steps out from the trees in front of me. The sight of the silver mask threatens to make my stomach plunge, but I harden myself and draw my dagger. The mask puts up his hands. "Peace, Lyre of Sarah." It is one of Aquila's masks, not the fair-haired one or the handsome one. This one reminds me of the freshly sharpened edge of an axe. This is the one who walked right past Elias and me in Ner. "I have to speak to the Blood Shrike," I say. "Please." "Where is your red-headed friend?" "Gone." The mask blinks. I find his lack of cold implacability unnatural. His pale green eyes are almost sympathetic. "And your brother?" "Still in Koth," I say warily. "Will you take me to her?" He nods. "We're breaking camp," he says. "I was scouting for the Commandant's spies." I halt. You have Elias?" "No," the mask says. "Elias is still inside. We have something pressing to attend to. More pressing than catching the Empire's top fugitive." A slow ember of hope kindles in my belly. I thought I'd have to lie to Helene Aquila and tell her I wouldn't interfere with her extraction of Elias, but she's not planning on leaving Koff with him anyway. "Why did you trust Elias, Lyre of Sarah?" The mask's question is too unexpected for me to hide my surprise. "Why did you save him from execution?" I consider lying, but he'd know. He's a mask. "Elias saved my life so many times," I say. "He broods and makes questionable choices that put his own life at risk. But he's a good person." I glance over at the mask, who stares impassively ahead. One of the best. "But he killed his friends during the trials." "He didn't want to," I say. "He thinks about it all the time. He'll never forgive himself, I think." The mask is silent and the wind carries the moans and sighs of cough to our ears. I clench my jaw. "You're going to have to go in there," I tell myself. "So get used to it." "My father was like Elias," the mask says after a moment. My mother said he always saw the good, where no one else did. Was he a mask too? He was. Strange trait for a mask, I suppose. The Empire tried to train it out of him. Perhaps they failed. Perhaps that's why he died. I do not know what to say, and the mask remains silent also until Koff's ominous black bulk appears in the distance. I lived there for 2 years, he nods at the prison. Spent most of my time in the interrogation cells. Hated it at first. 12-hour guard shifts, 7 days a week. I became numb to the things I heard. It helped that I had a friend. Not the warden. I inch a bit away from him. Elias told me about him. No, the mask says. Not the warden, nor any of the soldiers. My friend was a scholar slave. A little girl who called herself B, because she had a scar shaped like a zebra fruit on her cheek. I stare at him, nonplussed. He doesn't seem like the type of man to befriend a child. She was so thin, the mask says. I used to sneak her food. At first she feared me, but when she realized I didn't mean her harm, she started talking to me. He shrugs. After leaving Koff, I wondered about her. A few days ago, when I took a message to the warden from the Shrike, I went looking for B. Found her, too. Did she remember you? She did. In fact, she told me a very peculiar story of a pale-eyed marshal locked in the interrogation block of the prison. He refuses to fear the warden, she said. He befriended one of her companions, gave him a tribal name. Tass. The children whisper of this marshal. Carefully, of course, so the warden doesn't hear. They're good at keeping secrets. They've taken word of this marshal to the scholar movement within the prison, to those men and women who still hold out hope that they'll one day escape. Bleeding skies. Why are you telling me this? I look around, nervous. A trap, a trick. It's obvious that the mask is speaking of Elias. But what is his purpose? I can't tell you why. He sounds almost sad, but strange as it sounds, I think that one day you, of all people, will understand best. He shakes himself and meets my eyes. Save him, Liar of Sarah, he says, from all that you and the Blood Shrike have told me. I think that he is worth saving. The mask watches me, and I nod at him, not understanding but relieved that he is, at least, more human and less mask. I'll do my best. We reach the Blood Shrike's clearing. She fastens a saddle onto her horse, and when she hears our footsteps and turns, her silver face tightens. The mask quickly makes himself scarce. I know you don't like me, I say before she can tell me to get lost. But I'm here for 2 reasons. I open my mouth, trying to find the right words, and decide that simplest is best. First, I need to thank you for saving me. I should have said it before. You're welcome, she grunts. What do you want? Your help. Why in the bleeding skies would I help you? Because you're leaving Elias behind, I say. You don't want him dead. I know that. So help me save him. The Blood Shrike turns back to her horse, yanking a cloak from one of her saddlebags and pulling it on. Elias won't die. He's probably trying to break your brother out right now. No, I say. Something went wrong in there. I step closer to her. Her stare cuts like a sim. You owe me nothing, I know that. But I heard what he said to you at Blackcliff. Don't forget us. The devastation in her eyes at the memory is sudden and raw, and guilt twists in my stomach. I won't leave him, I say. Listen to that place. Helene Aquila looks away from me. He deserves better than to die in there. What do you want to know? A few things about layout, locations, and supplies. She scoffs. How in the hells are you going to get in? You can't pose as a slave. Koff's guards know the faces of their scholar slaves. And a girl who looks like you won't be quickly forgotten. You won't last 5 minutes. I have a way in, I say, and I'm not afraid. A violent gust of wind sends blonde strands fluttering like birds around her silver face. As she sizes me up, her expression is unreadable. What does she feel? She is more than just a mask. I learned that the night she brought me back from the brink of death. Come here, she sighs. She kneels down and begins to draw in the snow. I'm tempted to pile Keenan's things outside and light a fire, but the smoke would only attract attention. Instead, I hold his bag away from myself, as if it's diseased, and walk a few hundred yards from the cave, until I find a stream running swiftly down to the river Dusk. His pack lands with a splash in the water, and his weapons soon follow. I could do with a few more knives, but I don't want anything that belonged to him. When I return to the cave, I sit down, cross my legs, and decide that I will not move until I have mastered my invisibility. I realize that each time I succeeded, Keenan was out of sight and often far away. All that self-doubt I felt when he was around, could he have planted it on purpose? To suppress my power. Disappear! I scream the word in my mind, queen of the desolate landscape therein, ordering her ragged troops to a last stand. Elias, Darin, and all the rest I must save depend on this one thing, this power, this magic that I know lives within. A rush pours through my body, and I steady myself, looking down to see that my limbs shimmer, translucent, as they did during the raid on Afia's caravan. I whoop, loud enough that the echo in the cave startles me, and the invisibility falls away. Right, work on that, liar. All that day, I practice, first in the cave and then out in the snow. I learn my limits. A branch I hold while invisible is also invisible, but anything living or anchored to the earth appears to float in midair. I am so deep within my own head that at first I don't hear the footsteps. Someone speaks and I spin around, scrambling for a weapon. Oh, calm down, girl. I recognize the haughty tone even before she lowers her hood. Afia Arana. Skies, you're jumpy, she says, though I can't say I blame you. Not when you have to listen to that racket. She waves her hand in the general direction of the prison. No Elias, I see. No brother, either. And no redhead? She raises her eyebrows, waiting for an explanation, but I just stare at her, wondering if she's real. Her riding clothes are stained and filthy, her boots wet with snow. Her braids are tucked beneath a scarf, and it doesn't look like she has slept in days. I could kiss her. I'm so happy to see her. She sighs and rolls her eyes. I made a promise, girl, all right. I vow to Elias Veturius that I would see this through. A tribeswoman breaking a sacred vow is foul enough, but to do it when another woman's life is at stake, that is unforgivable. As my little brother reminded me every hour of every day, for 3 days straight, until I finally agreed to follow you. Where is he? Almost to the tribal lands. She sits on a nearby rock and massages her legs. At least he better be. Last thing he said to me was that your friend Izzy didn't trust the redhead. She looks at me expectantly. Was she right? Skies, I say. Where do I even begin? Night has fallen by the time I finish filling Afia in on the past few weeks. I leave out a few things, in particular the night in the cellar safe house. I know I failed, I say. She and I sit in the cave now, sharing a meal of flatbread and fruit that she has brought. I made stupid decisions. When I was 16, Afia interrupts, I left Ner to carry out my first trade. I was the oldest, and my father spoiled me. Instead of forcing me to spend interminable hours learning to cook and weave and other boring rubbish, he kept me close and taught me about the business. Most of our tribe thought he indulged me, but I knew I wanted to be Zoldara of Tribe Ner after my father. I didn't care that there hadn't been a female chieftain for more than 200 years. I only knew that I was my father's heir, and that if I wasn't chosen, the role of Zaldar would go to one of my greedy uncles or useless cousins. They'd marry me off to some other tribe, and that would be that. You pulled it off beautifully, I guess, with a smile. And now look at you. Wrong, she says. The trade was a disaster, a travesty, a humiliation for both myself and my father. The marshal I planned to sell to seemed honest enough, until he manipulated me and tricked me out of my goods for a fraction of what they were worth. I returned from the trade 1,000 marks poorer, with my head low and my tail between my legs. I was convinced my father would have me married off within a fortnight. Instead, he smacked the back of my head and barked at me to stand up straight. Do you know what he said? Failure doesn't define you. It's what you do after you fail that determines whether you are a leader or a waste of perfectly good air. Afia stares hard at me. So, you've made a few bad decisions. So have I. So has Elias. So has everyone attempting to do something difficult. That doesn't mean that you give up, you fool. Do you understand? I mull over her words and recall the past few months. It takes only a split second for life to go horribly wrong. To fix the mess, I need 1,000 things to go right. The distance from one bit of luck to the next feels as great as the distance across oceans. But, I decide in this moment, I will bridge that distance again and again until I win. I will not fail. I nod at Afia. Immediately she claps me on the shoulder. Good, she says. Now that that's out of the way, what's your plan? It's... I search for a word that will make my idea not look like complete lunacy, but realize that Afia would see right through me. It's insane, I finally say. So insane that I can't imagine how it will work. Afia lets out a peal of high laughter that rings through the cave. She is not mocking me. There is genuine amusement on her face as she shakes her head. Skies, Afia says. I thought you told me you loved stories. Have you ever heard a story of an adventurer with a sane plan? Well, no. And why do you think that is? I am at a loss. Because... She chuckles again. Because sane plans never work, girl, she says. Only the mad ones do.
Chapter 49 Elias. A whole night and day pass before Tess returns. He says nothing, looking pointedly at my cell door. There's a slight shift in the flickering torchlight beyond my cell. One of the warden's masks watches us. Finally, the mask outside the cell leaves. I bend my head in case he decides to return, keeping my voice quieter than a whisper.
Tell me you have good news, Tass.
The soldiers moved the artist to another cell.
Tass looks over his shoulder at the door, then draws swiftly in the grime on the cell floor.
But I found him. The block is arranged in a circle, yes, with the guard quarters in the center, and...
He marks an X at the top of the circle.
The artist is here,
he says. Then he marks an X at the bottom.
You are here. The stairs are in between.
Excellent, I whisper. The uniforms?
B can get one for you,
he says.
She has access to the laundry.
You're certain you trust her?
She hates the warden.
Tass shudders.
More than me, even. She will not betray us. But, Elias, I have not spoken to the Skirite leader, Araj, and...
Tass looks apologetic.
B said there's no Tellus to be found anywhere in the prison.
10 burning hells.
Also,
Tass says,
the scholar cleansing has begun. The marshals have built a pen in the prison yard where they are being herded. The cold has killed off many, but...
His voice trembles in anticipation, and I sense he's been working himself up to this.
Something else has happened. Something wonderful.
The warden has erupted in boils that will kill him slowly. Tass grins.
Almost as good,
he says.
I have a message, Elias, from a girl with golden eyes.
My heart practically falls out of my chest. It can't be. Can it be?
Tell me everything.
I glance toward the door. If Tass is in my cell for longer than 10 minutes, one of the masks will come to check on us. The boy's hands work swiftly as he cleans my wounds and replaces my bandages.
She found B first.
I strain to hear him. A few cells over, the guards have begun an interrogation, and the prisoner's screams echo across the block.
B thought it was a ghost, because the voice came out of nowhere. The voice led her to an empty barracks room, and the girl appeared out of thin air. She asked B about you, so B came to get me.
And she was invisible? At Tass's nod, I sit back, stunned. But then I begin to think back to the times she seemed to almost fade out of view. When did it begin? After Sarah, I realize. After the Ifrit touched her. The creature only laid hands on Lyra for a second. But perhaps that second was enough to awaken something within her.
What was her message?
Tass takes a deep breath.
I found your Sims,
he recites.
I was happy to see them. I have a way in and can keep out of sight. Afia can steal horses. What of the scholars? Executions have begun. The boy says there's a scholar leader who can help. If you see my brother, tell him I'm here. Tell him I love him. She said she'd return at nightfall for your answer.
All right, I say to Tass. This is what I want you to tell her.
For 3 days, Tass carries messages back and forth between Lyra and me. I'd have thought her presence here was a sick trick of the warden's, if it wasn't for the fact that I trust Tass, and that the messages he brings back are so eminently Lyra. Sweet, slightly formal, but with a strength behind the words that speaks of her determination.
Tread carefully, Elias. I do not wish to see you injured further.
Slowly, painstakingly, we pull together a plan that is part her, part me, part Tass, and complete madness. It's also heavily dependent on the competency of Araj, the man who leads the Skirite, a man I've never met. The morning of Rathana dawns like all other mornings in Koth, without any indication that it is morning, other than the sounds of the guards changing shifts and a vague internal sense that my body is waking up. Tass arrives with a bowl of watery gruel, which he drops quickly in front of me before streaking out. He is pale, terrified, but when I meet his eyes, he gives me the briefest of nods. After he leaves, I force myself to my feet. It takes most of my breath to stand, and my chains seem heavier than they did just last night. Everything hurts, and beneath the pain, weariness seems to have penetrated my very marrow. This is not the tiredness of interrogation or a long journey. It is the exhaustion of a body that's nearly done fighting.
Just get through today, I tell myself. Then you can die in peace.
The next few minutes are nearly as torturous as one of the warden's interrogation sessions. I hate waiting. but soon enough, a promising smell wafts into my cell. Smoke.